you make that sound like it's an easy question. Like, this is the starter question, but it's actually very hard.
So that's a good question. I think free will is...
What free will is actually a pretty complicated question.
So what is free will?
Hello, this is Free Will Matters. My name is Santiago Amaya, and I'm an associate professor in philosophy at Universidad de los Andes in Bogotá. I am the host of this podcast.
Hi, I'm Manuel Vargas, and I'm a professor of philosophy at the University of California, San Diego. I am also the host of this podcast.
The human ability to decide and act freely requires that we think of ourselves as agents of a particular kind. We must have the ability to form intentions, to deliberate, to exercise self-control, plan for the future, and so on. At the same time, we are creatures bound by the context and the circumstances that we occupy. What kind of agents, then, are we? How is our agency shaped by the world in which we live? For this season, our guests will be distinguished authors and researchers working on the philosophy of agency. The philosophy of agency can be a daunting endeavor, but with their help, we will get to know better the what, the how, and the why of our agency. Welcome.
For today's episode, our guest is Mirto Mailopoulos. Mirto is an associate professor in philosophy and cognitive science at Carleton University in Canada. She works on a number of topics, including the relation between agency and consciousness, skills and intentions, and motor representations. Her work has appeared in prestigious philosophy and cognitive science journals, including Philosophical Studies, Mind and Language, and Trends in Cognitive Science. Welcome.
Welcome, Mirto.
Thanks for having me.
Mirto, let me ask you one question to begin our conversation today. So many people think there's a close connection between being an agent and having a certain kind of consciousness. According to this line, not only is consciousness required for agency, but also, you know, voluntary actions feel in a distinctive way. There's a certain phenomenology to them. What can you tell us about this relationship? Are agency and consciousness connected? Can non-conscious creatures be agents? How does it feel to be an agent?
Great questions. So first off, I definitely think that there's some connection between consciousness and agency, and an important one. But I think at this point, it's safer to say that the connection is one of consciousness perhaps facilitating certain forms of agency rather than being required for agency, full stop. For instance, if we think about one type of sophisticated form of agency that many humans, most humans hopefully, can exercise, is the capacity for self-control. We can form plans and strategies for achieving certain goals that are important to us and guard against competing drives or inclinations that would cause us to abandon or otherwise fail to implement those goals. So for instance, if I decide I want to follow a strictly vegan diet for the next month, I might come up with specific meal plans, think about various vegan-friendly snacks I can have during the day. And if one evening I come across a competing desire to have steak or eat a bowl of ice cream, I can exert special effort to inhibit those desires or otherwise prevent myself from pursuing them. But that's a lot easier to do if you're aware of having the desire in the first place. If it's an unconscious desire, it's much harder, if not impossible, to take appropriate steps to ensure it doesn't drive your behavior in a direction that you don't want it to go. So I think the capacity to exercise self-control is one in which it's fairly straightforward that consciousness plays a really important role in facilitation, insofar as if we're not aware of various desires or drives that go against the goals that we've established for ourselves, we won't be able to exercise control in stopping ourselves from pursuing them. But that's not to say that consciousness facilitates all kinds of agency.
Let me stop you there, Mirto. You talk about different kinds of agents. What are these kinds of agents? Do they differ with respect to consciousness?
So when we think about more basic types of agency, such as pursuing simple goals that pertain to our routine actions, brushing our teeth, perhaps reaching for a cup to take a sip of water, I'm not sure that it's fair to say that consciousness has, or accurate to say, that consciousness has much to contribute. And a lot of empirical work on this question has to do with the role that consciousness might play in routine actions, ones that we've trained up through lots of repetition. So think about typing on a keyboard, which so many of us do regularly. It's probably safe to say that when we're typing on the keyboard, and if we're fairly experienced at doing so, we're not consciously aware of the individual keys we're pressing. We're not consciously aware of the kind of haptic experiences that we're having as we feel the keyboard under our fingers. What we're consciously thinking about is the sentence that we want to type, the idea that we want to convey. And here it seems as though conscious awareness of the kinds of psychological representations that are underlying this kind of fine-grained motor control isn't going to be that important. There, in fact, have been studies with skilled typists that show that once they've made an error in their typing, they'll reliably slow down right after, an indication that the error has been registered by the motor system, but they won't actually report that they've made an error if there's a correct response shown on the screen in front of them. So presumably they're unconscious of having performed an error, and they're unaware of the error itself and the registration of it. But nonetheless, the motor system is responding in an adaptive and corrective way to what's gone wrong. So I think that when it comes to these basic forms of agency, again, having to do with more routine and automatic behavior, consciousness has a lot less of a role to be played. Now, there's a lot of space in between those basic forms and the more sophisticated forms. And here I think that there's some room for agnosticism about the role that consciousness plays in different types of control. And the reason I'm tempted to be agnostic is because it's really hard to tease apart and to test for two different things that might be going on. The first is that in virtue of psychological states being conscious, control over behavior is made more reliable and efficient. It's the consciousness that's making the difference, the reliability. The second is that conscious states tend to correlate with more efficient or reliable exercises of control, but it's not so much the consciousness itself that's making the difference, but rather some other feature of the control system. So I prefer to remain agnostic, at least for now, with respect to consciousness playing a facilitative role in more sophisticated types of control that don't amount to the kind of basic agency that I described. Now, there's a second part to the question having to do with the kinds of experiences that we undergo as agents. And I think that the experience of being an agent is actually one of the most interesting facets of our phenomenology, and one that happily has recently started to get more attention from philosophers and cognitive scientists alike. Now, one thing that I think is really interesting about this type of phenomenology is that it's what I would call proprietary. And by that, I mean, I don't think it's reducible to other types of experience that we're familiar with. So importantly, I don't think it's reducible to kinds of sensory experience. Certainly when we perform actions such as reaching for a cup, we experience kinesthetic sensations of our limbs moving through space. We experience perhaps visual sensations of our bodily parts and their trajectory. But I think that agentive experience goes over and above these basic sensory experiences. It's not reducible to those types. It's its own distinctive type of phenomenology. Now, in some recent work that I've done with collaborators, I attempt to distinguish among different types of related and sometimes dissociable experiences that accompany action. So I don't think agentive experience is just one monolithic type. I think there are actually different elements to it that are really interesting to consider in their own right and can sometimes be teased apart. These might include an experience of authorship, a sense of me, myself, as being the author of some action, or an experience of control, the experience of having more or less control over some behavior I engage in. And some even think that there might even be an experience of libertarian freedom, the experience that I have indeterministic choice over a course of action when given a number of alternatives. Now, it might be hard with respect to our everyday activities to discern these different aspects of agentive phenomenology that I'm supposing exist. Here's where it can help to look to the cognitive sciences. So in particular, there are various forms of pathology or psychological conditions in which you seem to have an absence of one or other form of agentive experience. One example comes from individuals with schizophrenia who sometimes suffer from what are known as delusions of control. In these kinds of cases, the individual will engage in what looks from the outside to be intentional action, but disown the action in hand. So they'll say something like, it wasn't me who walked across the room, it was a computer controlling me, or it was the government. they'll attribute the action to some external agent. And one explanation for this is that there's something lacking in their experience in terms of the sense of authorship or mindness that we typically associate with the actions we engage in. Another kind of example comes from a condition known as anarchic hand syndrome. And this results from damage to certain parts of the motor cortex. And the consequence of this kind of damage is that one of the agent's limbs, typically the one that is opposite of the lesion in question, will perform goal-oriented actions that the agent cannot inhibit. Now, what's really striking about this condition is that if you look at the types of behaviors that the so-called anarchic limb engages in, they appear from the outside to be voluntary. So you have cases where an individual with the anarchic limb is playing chess, for instance, and their anarchic limb, they'll make a move in the chess game and the anarchic limb will take it back, right? So you even have scenarios where what's happening is that their behavior with respect to their one limb is at cross purposes with their intentions that they're coordinating the rest of their body in the service of. Now, what's clearly missing in this kind of case in a really robust way is a lack of the experience of control. There's no inhibition that they can engage in except for, you know, using their other hand to indirectly inhibit their behavior, but no direct inhibition. And they don't feel that they're guiding their behavior towards some goal. So I think these are some cases that help to illustrate different aspects of the phenomenology of agency. And I take this to be an area worthy of a lot of further study to uncover other components of it.
In addition to consciousness, you've also worked on the relationship between agency and control. Some people have thought that being an agent requires having some sort of control over one's behavior. Do you agree with this idea? What kind of control is characteristic of agents? Is it perhaps too demanding to ask agents to always be in control?
I do agree with the idea that there is a central relationship between agency and control. In fact, I think of an agent as a kind of entity that has a general capacity to control their behavior in line with their goals. And I think that this general capacity is itself instantiated by way of coordinating various bodily and psychological capacities, such as responding to different features of the environment, attending or orienting towards specific objects, deliberating about how best to achieve our aims, and so on. I think that understanding agency through the lens of control helps us to get a clearer view of different forms of agency, including human and non-human alike. So for instance, a particularly sophisticated form of agency might be required to achieve a kind of goal like planning a vacation or pursuing a degree in philosophy. But perhaps more rudimentary forms of agency, having especially to do with our perceptual capacities and motor behaviors, would be used to pursue more simple goals like foraging for food or escaping a predator. I completely agree that it would be a mistake to require of human agents that they always be in control. But I think that the requirement to have the capacity for some form of control, even if it isn't always successfully exercised, is a reasonable one, and one that I think seems to capture how we commonly think of agency in our everyday lives.
So that's very interesting. Let me ask you a question now about skill action, since this is one of your major topics of research. Skill actions are particularly interesting. On the one hand, they seem to require a lot of training and concentration. But on the other hand, it seems that skill actions are things that you do almost without thinking, very spontaneously. Can you tell us a little bit about skill actions? Which of these two elements do you think is characteristic of it?
Well, I hope this won't sound like a cheap answer, but I would wholeheartedly say both. In fact, this is something that more recently in the skill literature has reached a point of almost consensus, with many theorists attempting to characterize both the cognitively heavy-minded aspects of skill and the more spontaneous automatic aspects of it, and how, importantly, they work together. I think that there's certainly lots to say for the importance of automaticity in skill and the ways in which we often think of it as something mindless that is best done without thinking about it too much. One phenomenon that people use, I think, to illustrate this point and use quite well is known as the yips. So this is a kind of phenomenon where, in cases of high pressure, skilled agents are unable to perform routine tasks like sinking a putt in golf or throwing to a teammate in baseball. And what's thought that's happening in these kinds of cases is that the high pressure of the situation sometimes causes the skilled agent to feel anxiety and then explicitly monitor aspects of their performance, their precise wrist position or exactly how they're moving. And I think that there's some truth to that. I think in some cases, attention and monitoring directed towards one's automatized routines can certainly be disruptive. But what's important to note is that there's another explanation that has also gained some empirical support for what's happening in the yips. And this is that what agents are succumbing to is a loss in their focus. They're distracted. They're attending to irrelevant cues in their environment. And that's why their performance is disrupted. I think that at bottom, both explanations have some truth to them and can contribute to our understanding of a framework for skill on which both cognition and automatic control are essential. And recently in the skill literature, there's been some focus on expanding our understanding of the kind of thinking that skill involves, having to do with focus, attention, situational awareness, and even metacognition.
What's the difference between novices and skilled agents? Is it just practice, innate talent, something else? Inquiring minds want to know.
Well, I hope it can provide a satisfactory answer. I think there are different ways to think about the difference between skilled agents and novices. But in my own work, and again, a lot of this is collaborative, I focused on the difference in the types of psychological representations that skilled agents have versus novices related to their skill domain and the kinds of actions that their particular skill requires. So with respect to their skill domain, the idea is that experts have acquired very detailed and accurate models of that domain that can inform their particular strategy in any given situation and allow them to make optimal decisions, even in fairly novel or unpredictable circumstances. For instance, a tennis player knows exactly what their style of play is, what their strengths and weaknesses are, how it relates to other styles of play that their opponents might have, and how to exploit the weaknesses of their opponents. They also know what the difference is between playing on a clay court or a grass court on a windy day versus a calm day. All of these variables will inform a precise strategy for whether to play, for instance, defensively or aggressively, whether to start off strong or conserve energy for a later part of the match, and so on. The point being that they're able to flexibly respond to situations of all different stripes, given their knowledge of their domain. With respect to actions in the skill set, I think that skilled agents, experts in particular, also possess an advantage over novices and that they've built up representations of the action types they need to perform over time in ways in which action sequences are chunked into more complex hierarchical structures that relate actions to sub-actions. This allows for a special form of flexibility that a novice who's attempting to perform an action merely sequentially and has representations corresponding to each separate step of the element without being linked together doesn't have. So I would say that at bottom, the difference between a skilled agent, an expert, and a novice has to do with the types of psychological representations that they possess that drive their control.
So could I get really good at kung fu or coaching soccer by reading a bunch of books, spending a lot of time doing theory and trying to develop robust mental representations of what's involved in a roundhouse kick or how to respond to a certain kind of formation or a set of events on the field? Would that be enough to turn me, the novice, into a skilled agent if I just poured enough hours into really working on my mental representations?
I think you'd be great at cocktail parties talking about kung fu and talking about the different sports that you've read up about, but I don't think you'd be in a good place to actually perform these skills at an expert level. And the reason is that the kinds of representations that I take to be really important to exercising expert level control are representations that are instantiated in our sensory motor system and are the kinds of representations that get fine-tuned over time with practice and execution of the behaviors in question. So it's not enough to have theoretical knowledge about some skill domain, although that may perhaps help inform various strategies for how you approach different situations. What you need is some embedded knowledge that you arrive at through experience and that actually shapes your motor system in a certain way.
Yeah, so we don't want to get you into trouble here, Mirto, but can you tell us what, in your opinion, is the most pervasive mistakes that philosophers make when they talk about skill agency?
Yeah, so I'm reluctant to throw anyone under the bus here, so I won't. I'll keep my comment fairly general. I think that one thing that it's really important not to do when one is theorizing about skill is underestimating the intelligence of automatic motor control. And this is a point that's been made by many in the skill literature before me. But one thing that I think that is an aspect of understanding the intelligence of motor control is moving away from the idea that it's rigid or reflex-like and towards the idea that it's actually quite flexible, even insofar as it's an automatic form of control. And here, once again, I think the flexibility can be fruitfully explained in terms of the types of cognitive representations that are deployed in the exercise of skilled action. And if we start to pay more attention to the underlying representations and processes, I think it's much easier to appreciate the way in which even automatic, repetitive behaviors that skilled agents engage in have their own form of intelligence and flexibility.
Your research is at the intersection of a lot of different academic fields. It's philosophical, but it also focuses on things that matter to neuroscientists and engineers. Things like motor planning, limb coordination, and the details of movement production. How do these kinds of questions and concerns relate to one another? Are philosophical conceptions of agency relevant to understanding how our motor systems are designed and how they make possible our movements?
Absolutely. In fact, I think it's a two-way street. So I think the dialogue between cognitive scientists and philosophers is really important, both for philosophers to benefit from the work the scientists are doing and for scientists to benefit from the theoretical work philosophers are doing. So with respect to philosophical conceptions of agency, contributing to our understanding of how the motor system works, I would say that philosophy more generally, especially the philosophy of mind and cognitive science, offers us some really useful tools for thinking about the nature of representation, their formats, and other features that are essential to understanding how the motor system operates. Going in the other direction, I think philosophy of action has a lot to gain from engagement and dialogue with neuroscientists, psychologists, computational modelers, and others that work on the finer details of motor control. And here's one way I think that's been helpful for me to appreciate this point. So on one very influential theory within the philosophy of action, what it is to perform an action intentionally is for it to be caused in the right way, for the behavior to be caused in the right way by an agent's psychological states, like their beliefs, desires, or intentions. But the causal chain from an intention to actual behavior that's performed runs through the states and processes of the motor system. So in order to fully understand intentional action, and also the various ways in which it can break down, we have to understand how intentions hook up or interface with the motor system. In other words, a full account of intentional action should have something to say about how our intentions get implemented and not just how they are formed. And here's where I think cognitive science can play a particularly helpful role for philosophers thinking about these questions.
So we have one last question for you, Mirto. Can you tell us what are the most interesting topics and questions that philosophers of agency are discussing now, or not discussing, but will be discussing intensively over the next few years?
I think my answer to this question focuses more on the types of methods that I hope philosophers of agency will employ in the years to come than the topics they're interested in. I think traditional topics that philosophers have been working on for some time and that are doing great work in today, like self-control, free will, moral responsibility, the nature of intention and intentional action, all of these topics can be fruitfully informed by merging philosophical and scientific inquiry. So what I hope to see more of, and what we've also already started seeing in recent years, is a more open dialogue between the theorizing that philosophers are doing in our communities and the theorizing that and work that cognitive scientists are doing in theirs.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been my absolute pleasure.
It was fun to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Free Will Matters is part of the LATAM Free Will Agency and Responsibility Project. It is produced by 070, thanks to a generous grant of the John Templeton Foundation, and with the support of Universidad de los Andes and the University of California in San Diego. For more information, visit us at freewill.org. freewill.uniandes.edu.co. That is freewill.uniandes.edu.co.